The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So for those of you who were not here last week, I discussed a little bit the role of stories in religions, making up religious traditions have different stories. And then I offered you a story I'd made up. And the story I made up was based on this dichotomy between a wounded deer who is surprisingly taken care of by a tiger. And sometimes our life can be more like have some problem, and it seems like the universe, others, something comes along and supports us, and it's kind of like an act of grace, or act of surrender. And then other times, life requires us to be more like the tiger, rather than waiting for something, passively accepting situation as it is and allowing things to be. It requires us to act and be like a tiger who protects the deer or supports the deer. So the story was what it was, and what struck me after the talk last week was two of the questions afterwards, and in the question-answer period, and I wasn't quite prepared for the questions, and one of the because they kind of took the little Dharma talk I gave, and wanted to ask questions or prompted to ask questions about larger social issues in relationship to Buddhism. And one of the questions was about the Buddhist role, Buddhist clergy in Japan, their role in supporting Japanese war efforts. And there's now a well-documented books about the way in which Japanese Buddhist priests and monks very actively supported and justified the Japanese imperialism and the war efforts. And so how could that be? And then the second question had to do with the sex trade in countries like Thailand. Thailand being a Buddhist country, and there's a center of sex trade and also a fair amount of children involved in sex trade as well. So how could that compute? You know, how could a Buddhist country allow that or something? So in thinking about it this week, I thought, oh, on one hand, we had the Japanese tiger. The active support of war. And just the fact that you're a tiger and active doesn't mean necessarily it's right. And then perhaps if you allow, in Thailand, maybe there's a kind of passivity, an allowance of social injustice to happen, and so maybe there's more of a being the deer and not just kind of not trying to change or right something that's wrong. I don't know if that's a fair analysis, but I was struck by the questions, and so I spent actually a fair amount of time this week considering those questions and those concerns more, and partly because I felt my responses last week were quite inadequate. And one of the questions then is, what is the relationship of Buddhism and Buddhist culture, Buddhist society, Buddhism as a religion, to the social ills of our society, to the ills of our society, kind of larger issues? And in answering this, we have to kind of question a little bit what we mean by Buddhism. Where do we start when we try to understand Buddhism? And there's different choices. And one choice is to start with Buddhism as a world religious system and try to kind of get a sense of the overall theory or logic or teachings of the system. And once we understand the overall rationale of the system, then, apply it or justify it or engage it in the situation in our life. And many people are trying to figure out a way to live their lives and to figure out how to bring justice to this world or what's right or wrong. And so they naturally will look sometimes to philosophy, but more so they look to religions as one source of solutions. There has to be a solution or help. And so we study these different systems. And there are some of you, perhaps, who've studied different religions, and maybe in the process of studying different religions, trying to find which one you want to be aligned with or learn from. And that's one whole approach. So then you study, the doctrines of the Buddha, the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, the teachings of emptiness, the teaching of not self, the emphasis on ethics, the nature of awakening, the different kinds of awakening that exists, stages of awakening, and the history of history of all this and how it all applies. It's a whole you can study, very abstractly for a long time. You can get a PhD in Buddhism. And then another approach is not to start with Buddhism as a system or even as a religion, because maybe it's not a religion in the way that we think of in the West. Or maybe it is. Maybe it is and isn't both. And so we have to kind of question, if you hold it only as a religious system, as we would other religious systems, maybe we miss something very central to what Buddhism is. If there is a Buddhism, even. And so one of the ideas, so the other approach is not start with a religious system to understand its doctrines and tenets, but rather is to start with something much more close to ourselves, something much more immediate in our experience. And so a number of things we might choose, but one of them might be awakening itself. So rather than trying to understand what Buddhism is, we begin with our own experience of awakening, if we have some experience like that. And then what follows, so if you understand the system and the logic of the system, then you can ask, well, what follows from this logic, how I should behave and engage in the world? And if what you start with is awakening, then you can, what follows from that about how we engage in the world, the sense of meaning, the purpose, who I am? And when we start with awakening, then we have to have some sense of what awakening is. And awakening is not much. as you can say, it's not much to start with, perhaps. What is awakening? It's a kind of a key word in Buddhism. It's often associated with freedom, liberation. Sometimes we use the word enlightenment. And the word enlightenment has its advantages because you can play with the word light. And if you think here, all of you come home or come into the immediate present here to pay attention to something that maybe you're not paying attention to right now, but it's here and very present, is the space that's between us, the space that's here in the room. There's a lot of space in the room, ceilings high. And so to become aware of the sense of space that's between the individual sitting here and between the walls and the sense of space. The sense of space, the spaciousness, the space that's here, we normally don't pay too much attention to. It's maybe subconsciously aware of it. Some of you feel crowded because there's a lot of people here, so the space seems small. Some of you might look up to the ceiling and feel, this kind of feels a little bit spacious, and it might affect your mood or something, but you're not maybe you weren't consciously thinking about it until I brought it up. And now you become aware of this thing called space. Now in the space, in order to be aware of that space here and now, there has to be light. And because if it was dark, you wouldn't know how much space there was. You wouldn't know there was a ceiling. And so there's light that exists here. Now the space and the light even more than the space, is kind of, is light invisible? I'm not a physicist of light, but is it invisible, or is it by nature of being, it's invisible until it strikes something, right? And when it hits something, then you kind of see the effect of light, or I don't know how it works, but there's something about light. Light doesn't pertain to a doctrine. Space doesn't pertain to a doctrine. Light doesn't belong to self. It's not something you create and make out of your own self. Light doesn't have greed. Light doesn't have, or space doesn't have hate. Space is very accommodating. Is willing to hold anything, and light is willing to move through that space and be there, and reflect. So this is something that's here in this room, and you can kind of be aware of it if I point it out to you. But then, with a Buddhist turn, the Buddhist exercise is to turn that a little bit and say, and to point towards that awareness that's aware of the space and the light. There is no light or space. There is light and space, I suppose, but it's not an experience for you unless you are aware of it. Now, what is the nature of the awareness that is somehow tuned into the space here in this room, or the light that's here, this nebulous kind of sense of light that's very clear, very obvious, very present, but still something we can't quite put our finger on or touch? And what's the nature of that awareness? And what Buddhism sometimes will say is that that awareness is very much, has a lot of the same qualities as space, the awareness in and of itself. We might add or bring along in the heels of that awareness a lot of things. We might bring along our greed or our hate or our fear. We might bring a strong sense of self, self and other, a lot of values, history, beliefs. A lot of things can kind of be added to it, but those are added. And the nature of awareness itself is very, very simple in how it's experienced. And it has some of the same qualities of space. That's accommodating, holds everything. It, in and of itself, there's no greed, no hate, no delusion. It's just this clarity that's there. So if awakening is seen to be somewhat close, similar to this sense of clear, pristine awareness, that maybe we can point to a little bit, then if we start there, rather than with starting with a religious system, what follows? And how do we know what follows? You know, if we're not justifying our behavior then on a belief system, I believe certain things, therefore I act a certain way, then what do we, you know, we feel like we're not on any kind of solid ground. And is awakening itself, being in this kind of clear sense of awareness or opening or freedom, enough to guide one's life, enough to kind of have a sense of purpose and meaning in one's life? And how could you know if it does that, if it doesn't provide you with any doctrines? So it's kind of, you know, maybe it then becomes an act of trust, or through experience we realize that coming out of awakening becomes an effective, productive way of being in the world. One of the things that we're pointing to here, though, is that what comes out of awareness is action, not belief. If there is this clear, empty space, something has to move through the space. We have to act in it. So how do we act? And how we act then becomes very important in Buddhism, much more so than what you believe. Belief is part of it, but action becomes really central. So I don't know if this is boring you. Is this boring some of you? Well, then I would try to figure out a way to make it more engaging. Because
jury's out.
And jury's out. So, because I'm going to change directions. This was kind of a juncture. So you have to bear with me today. Hopefully the pieces will come together by the end of the talk. So in this week, thinking about these questions about these war and social injustice and the relationship of Buddhism to it, my thinking kind of coalesced around an exploration of what Buddhism has to say about human rights. And it's been pointed out by a number of people that human rights, the language and this discourse of human rights, comes out of a Western context. It arose kind of in the 1700s, 1600s, I think, very much in the West, and had a lot of kind of Western cultural assumptions about what it means to be a human being and what it means to be in society built into it. But it became a very strong and trend in Western thought, the idea of human rights. Started off what was called natural rights, and then became human rights, and is enshrined in the American Declaration of Independence, and And then in the 1940s, it was enshrined in the United Nations Universal Declaration of Human Rights. So it became something more global, not just part of Western culture. But still, it came out of that. And sometimes it's been pointed out that maybe the notion of human rights, which seems for many people in Western cultures, seems so obvious that should be there, maybe it's not so obvious in other cultures. And perhaps the very notion of human rights does a kind of harm to some perfectly good understandings of human nature and understanding of what it means to be human that other cultures have. And so maybe it's even a form of imperialism to kind of bring it on to people elsewhere. And the Dalai Lama, as a representative of Buddhism, he seems to have shied away from using the notions of human rights in his discussion, but rather what he uses is an idea of human responsibilities. So he talks about human rights some, but he prefers seemingly to talk about human responsibilities to human rights. So what's that about? And how can we look at this? Human rights, the idea of we have rights, can lead itself to the idea that we're entitled. And so, you know, we should be provided. We have a right to certain things, and so then we should just be provided with that. And we have a right to an education, so someone, we're entitled to that, so someone should provide me with an education, thank you. We have a right to health care, or a right to, you know, to vote, or right, all kinds of rights that people have. And once you use the word entitlement, then it starts becoming a little bit awkward, because then people start insisting that other people should treat themselves in a certain way while they're being somewhat passive. You know, and so I just live my life, and people should provide me with all the things that I'm entitled to, thank you. And I don't know if that's a useful way of living a life. So, but the idea of rights has two sides to it. It has a side of, if someone has a right, then someone else has a duty to provide that right. So if, and the example that's been given sometimes is that if I borrow a lot of money from one of you, it's a loan, then we sign a contract that, you know, that I'm going to pay you back, then you have a right to get paid back from me according to the conditions of the loan. That's your right. And I'm obligated, I have a responsibility to provide that. If I don't pay back the loan, then it's the role of our government it's the duty in the sense of government to ensure that I fulfill my obligation. So we kind of expect there's a right, as a lender, you have a right to get paid back, and you're entitled in our society to get support and help from the government. We have an agreement that's what they're part of the function of the government to do, is to help make that happen. But there's two sides. There's a sense of the right to get paid back, and my obligation, my responsibility to pay it back, and also the sense of the role of someone, other institution like government, to pay it back as well, or to help make it happen. So the argument then is that the idea of rights goes hand in hand, like two sides of a hand, the front and back side of a hand, with the sense of an obligation or a duty or responsibility. And where should the emphasis be on? Should the emphasis be on the right in terms of an entitlement, or should the emphasis be on the responsibility? And an argument has been made that in Buddhism, the emphasis is more emphasizes more on the responsibility we have rather than what rights we have. And again, maybe you can't separate them; they're two sides of a hand. But the results can be a little bit different. If the emphasis is on responsibility, then the emphasis is then the tendency is to not look for entitlement, but rather in what's being asked of me. What's required of me in this situation? So if there's a right to education, then we wait for someone to provide it to us. If it's our responsibility to provide education, then we look for how can we help and support other people to be educated, to be better educated. And so it has a little different feeling of what's going on there. And so the tendency in Buddhism has been not to look for inalienable rights, but rather to look for how is it best for us, how should we act in the world in a responsible way. Now, when people hear that, oh, now I'm going to be now I'm held responsible, a lot of people are going to flee Buddhism, mm-hmm. because they don't want a religion that tells them what to do. At least a lot of people, I've noticed a lot of people coming to Buddhism in the West are kind of trying to free themselves of a religion that had these strong tenets and beliefs that thou shalt do it this way. And so Buddhism says, you know, they think that Buddhism says, you know, trust yourself, follow your own experience, find the truth for yourself. And then they hear that Buddhism teaches you should be interested in your responsibilities. Then the question is, what responsibilities do I have? And this now seems like I'm adding all these things to on top of myself, and I feel so bad about myself already. And now you're telling me I have to do even more things that I'm not even doing now, and so now there's even more reason to feel bad. And the language of rights, you know, or the idea of innate perfection or goodness feels better. I'd rather have a religion that tells me how good I am, that doesn't require anything of me, than to have a religion that requires things of me. I need to do something. So we find in a lot of Western Buddhism a fair amount of emphasis on innate goodness, innate Buddha nature, kind of teaching that helps us to feel good about who we are, as opposed to teaching that emphasizes action, how we should act, what we should do. So, but even so, the notion of responsibility and the notion of rights might not be concepts that belong to Buddhism. We're trying to take Buddhist Western concepts that are very important in Western discussion of human life and trying to find how can we make it work for Buddhism. What does Buddhism have to say about it? And I'd like to offer a separate word, a different word, that I think maybe is more integral or closer to the Buddhist approach than both the idea of rights and responsibilities. And that is the notion of reciprocity or mutuality. That what it means to be a human being, from a Buddhist point of view, is to be involved in reciprocal relationships. Is to be involved in mutual relationships. And so when we look at ourselves as being in relationship, then what are the relationships call for? What do they require? And so, for example, if you're in a committed relationship, a marriage or a partnership, there's often a good counsel given, and I sometimes say this when I have done wedding ceremonies, commitment ceremonies. I'll say something like, you know, a partnership like this is not a done deal. You don't just go through a ritual and then it's, you know, it's done, you know, and you just kind of retire. But rather, it's something that you need to ongoingly recreate and reaffirm, and, you know, it requires ongoing, it's a relationship that requires kind of recreating all the time. And so once you have a committed relationship, that commitment comes with reciprocity, with a mutuality that we're responsible for from having agreed to go into that mutual relationship. And so we can ask, what is that relationship a call for us? And so different things, perhaps different relationships call for different things, but it calls for honesty, perhaps. It calls for contact, conversation, you know, mutual support. And so, you know, maybe we can understand that in relationship to a committed relationship. But then in Buddhism, there's a list of other kinds of relationships that are reciprocal. And it's only in the reciprocity that the relationship exists. It doesn't exist in the abstract. It exists because we choose to act a certain way. One of them is the relationship between a student and a teacher. There is no relationship between a student and teacher unless one person comes as a student and the other person comes as a teacher. The whole thing gets created by the actions of two people. Sometimes people come to me and say, you know, will you be my teacher? And I've said sometimes in the past, I've said, well, it's a student that makes the teacher. You know, I'm just going about my life, bumbling along, you know, trying to do the best I can. And then if someone comes along and relates to me as a teacher, asks me a question, and I think I have an answer, I'll say something in response, and then I'm a teacher. You know, I'm teaching. And so the situation makes me a teacher. It's a reciprocity. Now, if I go around with the idea that I am a teacher without the active, reciprocal, mutual relationship that makes that relevant, then I would think I'm deluded. You know, because, you know, then I'm carrying myself as a teacher around the world. I'm the teacher, look at me. And then I go around, you know, insisting that everyone, you know, share in that particular construct. You know, I'm a teacher and you better see me this way. And I've, you know, tried, you know, when I first was married to my wife, I'd come home sometimes, I'd be talking with her sometimes, and she would look at me and say, "Gil, you're using that voice again." And what she meant was that the teacher voice. It's completely, you know, in terms of reciprocity, what that relationship is with my wife, that's not the place to be a teacher. So I was carrying this delusion, right? I had this, you know, carrying this idea, and I was out of its normal context of reciprocity. So that was my delusion. So there's a certain reciprocity that comes with that. And so so what does that relationship call for? What does it require? And different cultures requires different things, perhaps, or calls for or held different ways, and so different things are called for. Another reciprocal relationship that exists for people is that of between parents and children, and even adult children. And so that doesn't exist in the abstract, it's kind of a set thing, but also it's a relationship. And so what does that relationship call for? What kind of action, what kind of behavior is called for in order for that reciprocal relation to be there? I would suggest that sometimes it becomes a problem in families when one of the other members of the family assumes that they have a right to being treated a certain way, independent of it being reciprocal. And, I mean, sometimes we go along with that. I mean, my mother for years would go along with that because I would come home to her as an adult, visit her, and I was very happy just to do nothing and get fed and have my clothes cleaned and all these things. And, you know, now I thought all I had to do was just do nothing. And I kind of deserved it, or so that's the way it worked, but... But in Buddhism, the idea is that a parent-child situation is a reciprocal relationship that has mutual actions or responsibilities on both sides, mutual forms of support and respect and different things. Another reciprocal relationship that's emphasized in Buddhism is that between, and remember this goes back now to the ancient times, between a ruler and citizens of a country, that there's a reciprocal relationship there. Maybe nowadays we say between a government and its people. And it's reciprocal, that there's responsibilities in both directions. And without some sense of the citizens having responsibility to society or the government or the rulers, then you can't expect the government in return to have responsibility for its citizens. And there's a big discussion, of course, and controversies around these kinds of issues, but to be simplistic, since it's just we paid our taxes a few days ago. We have, in a sense, responsibility to pay our taxes and then support the government. And then from that support to the government, we get support in return in a variety of ways. And so, again, we're looking at reciprocal. So do those things exist in some kind of inherent way? Do they exist before the creation of the relationship? No. But if you want to be in that relationship, any of those kinds of relationships, then they call for certain kind of actions on our part. So reciprocity, what's called for in the mutuality of our relationships? And so Buddhism tends to put the emphasis on understanding the mutuality, understanding the interconnected aspects of how we relate to others, to the world around us. And then once we understand that interrelatedness, the mutuality, what actions does it call on us to maintain that in a healthy way, in an appropriate way? And again, so the emphasis is what does it call on for us? Tendency in Buddhism, for better or for worse, better and worse, is to point the finger back to you, to the person, to say, what is your role? What's your responsibility? What do you contribute to this? As opposed to, what do you receive? We receive a lot, and there are ways in which we can expect to be, you know, if people want to be in a relationship to us, we can expect certain things in return. You know, there's a contract in a sense for that. But the emphasis over and over again is, what is my role? What do I contribute? How do I step up to the plate? What do I give here? So to give you a very simple, I think, practical understanding of this, or example of this, there are times when I felt that someone has not been treating me properly. And then I can get, you know, they're not treating me with enough kindness. That person. And then I kind of, I can't believe how unkind that person is. And then I'm going to wait until the person treats me kindly. You know, the person better, you know, get on with it. I'm just waiting here. Another approach is to, well, the person's not treating me kindly, but I'm, you know, what I'll do is I'll treat that person kindly. That person's not being generous, so I'll be generous to that person. That person's not being, you know, so there's something I want. Rather than waiting for that to be provided, turn it around 180 degrees. And how can I act on this? Move forward and offer it instead. Sometimes it seems to have a kind of this magic quality to turn it around that way. So rather than waiting for someone to love you, rather than waiting for your partner to love you, love your partner and see what happens. So take responsibility for the relationship. Do what we can, offer what we can. It does a number of things. It can help with the relationship. It shifts the emphasis and can kind of support the other person or help the other person change, perhaps. But also, it's an exercise of our own freedom. Rather than being a victim, rather than being stuck in a certain way, we're acting on our freedom to act. And the emphasis in Buddhism, again, is on action and the freedom to act. Freedom in Buddhism, the awakening, the freedom of awakening, has a lot to do with being free to act. And to act freely. And to feel that in our ability to act freely, we find ourselves, we find our freedom. So where do we begin? Do we begin with Buddhism as an abstract field of concepts and ideas? Or do we begin by the mindfulness and presence that puts us here in the present moment fully and completely? And then if we're here, completely here now, then we find ourselves in relationship to others. We find ourselves in relationship to the present moment. And then what is being asked of us? What's our opportunities here and now to respond, to act, to do something? The mutuality of a relationship also points to opportunities. And this is, you know, The possibility of awakening points to the opportunity of peace, of freedom, of compassion, of clarity, of not being in conflict. So the reference point in Buddhism, I was going to say it this way. It's been pointed out that the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights is a series of declarative statements without any justification. Maybe it doesn't need any. But from a Buddhist point of view, there needs to be a... If we're going to act in the world, there needs to be a sense of the consequences of that action and taking responsibility for the consequences. So to be a Buddhist is also to be concerned with a vision of what's possible. And so the vision of what's possible, ultimately in Buddhism, is a profound experience of liberation, of freedom, of awakening. From that point of view of awakening or freedom, that informs the choices we make and how we act, how we take responsibility, how we engage in that reciprocal world. So it's not just a matter of what is the relationship that I'm involved with the world, but also what's possible in that relationship. Is it possible to support and help other people? Support and help myself? To experience the highest good, the highest benefit, the highest experience of peace, of well-being, of freedom, of benefit that's possible for a human being. The hope is that when we start with awakening, experience of awakening, a clarity, immediacy, where there is, in a sense, no even kind of self-consciousness in that clarity, like there's no self-consciousness in the space that's here, that sense of freedom or peace that provides becomes a reference point for what's possible to move towards or move with. And so the choices we make is somehow informed by that. So, and we're from a Buddhist point of view, we're the custodians of that possibility for others, or the supporters of the possibility for others. So when Buddhists live by the precepts, the five precepts, for example, they can partly be seen as upholding our responsibility or the mutuality, the reciprocity of how we can offer and act as a way of being supportive of the relationships that we're in. So the relationships we're in and so the people we encounter get supported in the best possible way for their own betterment, better future. So the precepts become, in a sense, a responsibility. Not because there's an obligation to live by the precepts. Not because there's an obligation to be an engaged Buddhist. Not because there's an obligation to act for the betterment of others. And you find very hard to find in Buddhism any sense of you're obligated. But if you're going to be involved in the mutual world, if you're going to be engaged in the world of relationship, then we have a responsibility for what those relationships call on us to do. So how does that relate to war and the sex industry? I think when we focus on such large social issues like that, you know, if we focus on personal issues, the world that we encounter in our own immediate life, awakening can take you a long way to know how to act and live effectively, beneficially for others. But when we look at the larger social issues like that, do we need to have more than just our own awakening? Do we need to have a bigger, wider understanding of what's going on in society and also of different world, different religious systems, understandings, and so that there can be a relationship between the more complex social dynamics of our life, or our times, and our awakening. And so for some people, then, the bridge between awakening and the larger world is the religious system that we're involved in. And so Buddhism has, I think, a very beautiful religious system of beliefs and doctrines that can help support that bridge. So the hope that is that there's not a black and white separation between awakening and the religious worldview or system of Buddhism. And you find some teachers who want to make a very strong separation between the two. And I think there's also there mutuality and mutual support between those two. And my hope is that as Buddhism takes root in this country here, that it becomes a participant with other religious systems here in this country, in this culture, becomes a participant in the larger public discourse about what it is to, how as a society we care best for our society. So that Buddhism isn't just simply a meditation tradition where people sit and look at their breath, their breathing, and try to experience their own sense of well-being. But Buddhism is intimately connected to addressing the larger social issues of our times. And can talk about it in articulate and clear ways from the point of view of its particular understanding of human nature or human life or this reciprocal thing that I've talked about today. And that its contribution to all this, maybe, is, among other things, is twofold. One is the strong introspective aspect of Buddhism. So the Buddhism has this very strong introspection. We really understand what's going on inside of ourselves, the intentionality, the motivation for how we act. It can be very hard to understand the motivations, the deep drives in the human psyche that get us to act in the way that we actually act. So meditation and introspection of Buddhism helps us to look deep, deep, deep into that and clarify and purify it. And the second contribution is the experience of profound peace, liberation, well-being, happiness that comes when the heart has been liberated, freed from some of the unhealthy motivations that can be in there. And that experience of liberation then, that sense of well-being, then becomes a guidepost, a guide for helping us understand, make decisions about how we act, the choices and decisions we make. Because without having some guide like that, you're going to use some other guidepost, some other guidelines for making decisions. There might be other really good ones, but too many people in our society don't reflect about the guidelines or the reference points they use for making their decisions. And when we don't reflect on it, then two things happen. It either becomes our own selfish concerns, or we all too easily, subconsciously, adopt or take on what our society tells us should be our values and decisions. And so then becomes, for example, it becomes about consumption, shopping, or something else. So rather than letting it somehow unconsciously taking up the values of some of the unhealthy values of our wider society, or taking up just selfish concerns, awakening is considered to be a much more healthy and appropriate reference point for knowing how to make our decisions and guide our life. Okay, so I'll probably spend this week also reflecting about how inadequate my responses have been to those two questions last week. So stop digging. So we'll see what happens next week. So if this was trying for you, I apologize. And so enjoy your Sunday. Thank you.